Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There is a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. Hello, my name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each and every week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. This is episode 363 with Charles Duff and Cities of Friendship and Love. This episode of Entree Architect Podcast is supported by our platform sponsors, FreshBooks, the cloud-based accounting software that makes running your small firm easy, fast, and secure. Spend less time on accounting and more time doing the work you love. Gusto, the easy online payroll and benefit service built for modern small businesses like ours. In other words, it's a people platform. And RCAT, the online resource delivering quality building material information, CAD details, BIM specifications, and so much more, all for free. Thanks to FreshBooks and Gusto and RCAT for supporting Entree Architect and the Entree Architect community of small firm architects. Charles Duff, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Well, thanks. Good to be here.
It is great to have you here. Charles Duff is a planner, teacher, developer, and historian. In a career of more than 35 years, he has built or rebuilt more than 300 buildings and led the revival of some of Baltimore's most successful neighborhoods. He has been president of Jubilee Baltimore, the city's premier community development nonprofit, since 1987. And has been president of the Baltimore Architecture Foundation. A graduate of Amherst College and Harvard University, he lectures widely in America and elsewhere and has taught at Johns Hopkins University. He wrote Then and Now, Baltimore Architecture in 2005 and contributed to the book, The Architecture of Baltimore. And in his new book, The North Atlantic Cities, he has just published that in the UK and it's available here, right here in the United States, where I am and where I'm recording. Charles, it's great to have you with us here today. This is going to be a fun conversation. You and I talked a little bit prior to hit and record, and I think you and I are going to have a fun conversation here. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. There's an art to making a guy feel comfortable on what's essentially radio, and you have that art. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Charles. I appreciate that. Let's start where it all started. Let's start with your origin story. When did you discover the passion for what you do today? What and maybe who inspired you? And share that journey with us here at the podcast.
Well, I am a nonprofit real estate developer, and I've done that all my career pretty much. And when I tell people that, they usually look at me kind of squint-eyed and say, isn't that kind of like being a nonprofit contract hitman or something? You don't really do that. But I do. And it's because I come from Baltimore. And Baltimore needs to be rebuilt and maintained. And I love the place. I love the people. I had fun in New England, going to school, had fun at the GSD, had fun in Europe. And wherever I went, I found this is nice, but the people I really love are in Baltimore. And what I want to do is to rebuild a great city. So I need to have a city that needs rebuilding, and it needs to be great. And I thought, what a lucky slug I am that I actually got born into a place that needs what I want to do. When did I discover my vocation? I can make it sound simple. From a real revelation one day when I had just turned 15 and, you know, I was doing volunteer work at a hospital and a guy in the boiler room sent me down to the commercial street for a part. And I found myself in an 18th century waterfront neighborhood where all the houses were boarded up and vacant. And I thought Baltimore was just an ugly Victorian city. I had no idea it had anything like that. And I had no idea why it was vacant, and I didn't know anybody who knew. So it turned out that part of town was about to get torn down for an interstate highway. But there was some bunch of mucklucks who were trying to stop that. So I joined them and knocked on doors and gave 15-year-old speeches at public meetings and got interested in building cities. And I can make that sound simple. It wasn't so simple because I got interested in lots of other things too. But finally realized that this was it. So decided I should be an architect and went to school. You know, by that time I was out of college. I thought I had to learn to draw. So I went to the Maryland Institute College of Art to learn to draw. And I realized that God had not made me to be an architect. I had to do something else. So I said, well, you know, when something really moves me, I don't reach for a brush and I don't reach for a pencil. What do I reach for? And I reach for my larynx, that I try to persuade people to do things, or I try to think things through out loud. So I said, okay, how can you rebuild a great city with your larynx? And I wound up as a nonprofit developer. And you can thank the Harvard GSD and the Harvard Business School. And that was a lot of fun. I learned a lot. So that's basically it. If you want to understand why I do what I do, come to Baltimore and let me show you around. And I will show you one of the great cities of the world, but a city that needs what I do and needs more than I can do. And it needs what you do too. And it'll reward you because it's that good.
I'm going to take you up on that, Charles. I'm going to come up and visit because I would love a tour.
I ran tours for the Baltimore Architecture Foundation for years. I'm getting good at it.
Yeah, I would love to do that. My mom is an American history buff. She loves American history. And so she used to take us on day trips to cities, and we would go on vacation to places like Williamsburg. And I grew up in Bergen County in New Jersey. And so there's lots of history there all around New York City. And so it's in my blood, it's in my veins, and I really enjoy it. It makes me happy because it takes me back to my childhood. And so to have somebody take me around a city, someone who knows the history of the city and understands how it developed, it's fascinating to me, the evolution of cities. And so I think it'll be a lot of fun to have you share that knowledge with me in a private tour. But I'd love to also share that right here today.
Pandemic's over. Let's get up a tour for your worldwide public.
Yeah, that sounds good too.
Baltimore or any of the North Atlantic cities. By now, I've tramped through all of them.
So you just published a book, the North Atlantic Cities. I don't remember in architecture school and in architecture history class cities being categorized as North Atlantic cities. Can you explain what we're talking about? Which cities are we talking about? What makes a North Atlantic city unique? Why are you defining it as such?
Right. I don't remember ever hearing about North Atlantic cities either. I didn't invent them, but I think I discovered them. And it's hard to believe that they needed discovering because they're pretty big. And they're really different from other kinds of cities. And I first noticed this when I was 20. I had a junior year abroad. I grew up, you know, in the middle Atlantic states, and, you know, you didn't fly around a lot in the 1950s and 60s if you were a little kid. So I grew up in Baltimore, and every now and then I went to Washington, and every now and then I went to Philadelphia, and that was about it. And so if you grew up as I did, you grew up thinking that cities are things that have row houses. That's what a city is in the Middle Atlantic. Yeah. And it may have other things, like Independence Hall in Philly or the Washington Monument in Washington. But the dominant impression that you take away from a city in the Middle Atlantic is an impression of row houses. In fact, I remember a friend of my dad's from the South came up to Baltimore for the first time. Dad drove him around. And he said, "Nice town you got here, Charlie, but tell me, how do Baltimore drunks find their way home at night? All the houses look the same." So, you know, then I was 20. I went over to the UK, spent a year in Scotland, and got down to London as often as I could and wandered around England, Bath, all these places. And they were really different and really sometimes awful, sometimes delightful. But they were cities of row houses. And that didn't affect me one way or another because that's what I thought a city was. And then the next summer I went over to Paris. And Paris has a lot of stuff. And it's pretty wonderful, most beautiful city I know. But it doesn't have row houses. Paris is a city of apartment houses. And even New York has row houses, they call them brownstones. Paris was the first city I had ever been in that was totally different from any city I'd ever been in. And I wandered around continental Europe, and it turned out that all the cities of continental Europe, Italy and Germany and France, were cities like Paris. They were cities of apartment houses. They were cities of very high density, and they had pretty active street life, and they were great fun to wander around, and they were really different. And I had just turned 21, and I said, gee, I want to know why there are two ways of building cities. I can't be the first person who ever noticed this. Somebody must have written about it. I want to read the book. So a couple of years later, I went to the American Midwest, to Minneapolis, and I found there was a third kind of a city, which I would describe as suburbs around skyscrapers. And that turns out to be the typical way of building cities in most of the United States, even in Canada. So in between the apartment house cities of continental Europe and the suburban cities, the sprawling cities of continental North America, you have the row house cities. You find them on both sides of the North Atlantic Ocean. Here in our country, you see them along the coast from Richmond in the south to New York in the north, with a northern outlier in Boston and a southern outlier in Savannah. And they go inland about as far as the Ohio River Valley, and that's about it. That's the row house region of America. And then there's a row house region in Europe. It's the UK, it's the Republic of Ireland, it's the Netherlands, it's Belgium. And it's got a couple of outliers in North Germany and a couple of outliers in coastal France, but that's about it. So you've got this, here's a way of building cities. It's a region of architecture and city building. And it's in two halves and they're separated by this giant ocean. And I thought, well, I can't be the first person who ever noticed this. Somebody must have figured this out and written about it. I want to read that book. And 10 years ago, I realized I'd never found the book, so I'd have to figure it out. So the key thing about North Atlantic cities, if you want to know whether your city is North Atlantic or not, first question to ask is, does it have old row houses? If it has old row houses, it's probably a North Atlantic city. Even Melbourne, Australia, I'm told, has old row houses, but I didn't have the budget to go there. And if you're, you know, if you have the frame of mind of a planner, another way to think of the North Atlantic cities is that they are cities of moderate density. They're in between the high density cities of continental Europe, where people live in small apartments and they go to restaurants a lot. And that's on one side. And then on the other side, the low density cities of continental America, where you can entertain at home, but you have to get in a car or a pickup and drive somewhere to buy a tube of toothpaste. The North Atlantic cities are cities of moderate density, 20 to 50 units to the acre. You can't have retail on every street. They're not that dense, but you can be within walking distance of a commercial street. And if you go to the really good North Atlantic cities like London or Washington or Boston, the ones that are firing on all cylinders, any of the Dutch cities, it really works. You can have a house that's fit to live in. You can know your neighbors. You're not ground in people. But you want public life? No problem. 3-minute walk, 4-minute walk. You want to live without a car? No problem. You've got enough density to support mass transit. You don't have to be as dense as New York or Paris. My favorite mass transit system is in London, and London's the greatest row house city in the world. So that's what the North Atlantic cities are, and that's where you find them.
Were the row house cities all, well, at least the row house part of the row house cities, when they were being developed, were they all being developed at the same time? Were all the cities becoming row house cities? Because prior to row houses, colonial times and earlier, they weren't row houses. They were smaller individual homes, right? Cities before they became cities were not row houses. Was it an influence from Europe to New York and the American, North Atlantic cities, or did they all sort of happen simultaneously and around the same periods?
What we think of as the row house, this brick thing that's 15 or 20 feet wide, 2 or 3 or 4 stories tall, was invented by the Dutch in the first half of the 1600s. The Dutch were the first fully middle-class society anywhere in history. And they needed a way of creating real architecture on a middle-class budget. Plus, they were building real cities, and they needed to have walls around them because the Spaniards were at war with them. And they took the rattle-trap city houses of the Middle Ages, and they figured out how to build them of durable materials, brick, and how to touch them with the magic wand of architecture, as a friend of mine likes to say. They made them into architecture. The British rapidly picked up on this and had just figured out how to build Dutch-style row houses when Shazam in 1666, the city of London burnt down. And it all had to be rebuilt. And Parliament passed a rebuilding act that said, thou shalt build Dutch-style brick row houses and thou shalt not do anything else. So people came to London from all over the UK to learn how to build brick row houses. And when the job was done 7 years later, they all had to go somewhere else and they took their skills with them. And so you get, on this side, you get an interesting thing. Philadelphia was started in 1682. And that's 16 years after the rebuilding of London. Philadelphia is a row house town from day one. It's a brick town from day one. But Boston is 50 years older.
Yeah.
And Boston was started before the row house revolution. And Boston doesn't build row houses until the 1790s, because there's one guy who, you know, takes the grand tour and likes modern architecture and brings it back to Boston. So by the end of the 18th century, row houses have snob value. If your town has row houses, your town is a city, or it's trying to be a city. And if you wonder what the row house meant to our ancestors, the row house meant what the skyscraper means to us. If you've got skyscrapers, you're a city. If you haven't got skyscrapers, you're a town. So much for you.
Right. In June of 2019, I moved from New York to Charlotte, North Carolina. So I grew up around New York City, spent a lot of time in New York City throughout my entire childhood and my adult life. And then in 2019, I moved to Charlotte. Definitely not a North Atlantic city. It's more like the city you talked about earlier. It's really a city of sprawl. There's sky, you know, the skyscrapers in the middle. It's a beautiful city. It's clean. It's a wonderful place to visit. But there's nothing stopping its development from continuing to grow horizontally. And so there's lots and lots of sprawl, and there's no necessity for density. The cities that you're describing, the North Atlantic cities that you're describing in your book, have a very certain way of life and a certain character and they work in a certain way. They're successful in certain ways. What can cities like Charlotte and the, I don't know, 100 of other cities that are like Charlotte, right? Because if you've been to Charlotte, you've been to many of the cities that are growing up in North America today. What can cities like Charlotte learn from North Atlantic cities to make them better?
Well, you know, you say there's nothing stopping sprawl. Just wait for climate change. What a city like Charlotte can learn from a city like London or a city like Boston or a city like Washington is how to get enough density to make it possible to live without a car, live a good life without a car, how to get that much density without jamming yourself into a small apartment building, you know, how to get that much density and still be able to raise your kids in a normal way, be able to putter around the kitchen and watch your kids in the backyard, or, you know, have enough neighbors, but not too many, sort of the way normal Americans normally live. You can do that at the moderate density of the row house city. If we all of a sudden had to live at New York density or Paris density, we'd probably have to get the Chinese to set up re-education camps for us. I don't think we're going to do that quickly. But you know, when you've already got a sprawling landscape, and believe me, the North Atlantic cities have it too. I mean, I take you around the sprawl around Washington or Philadelphia.
Yeah, sure.
You know, you're not exempt from it. I think the greatest challenge for the next generation is going to be retrofitting post-war American suburbia to make it greener. The best examples I know are in Washington. And if you go to Washington and look at a street like Connecticut Avenue, the big avenues named after states, you'll see that the big wide avenues have apartment houses. And the apartment houses have enough density to support retail on the ground floor. But out behind the apartment houses, you just have houses. And sometimes they're row houses, but very often they're, you know, freestanding house American suburbia. And everybody wins because the apartment houses have enough density to support retail and mass transit. And the families with children living out behind the apartment houses can all walk to retail and mass transit. It's a win-win. And if you come to Baltimore and get my tour, I will show you some commercial arterials that are just sitting there waiting to have apartment houses and make their neighborhoods really work. Any architect in a small firm, or almost every architect in a small firm, does a lot of domestic renovation work. And post-war suburbia needs as much domestic renovation as anything else because kitchens are too small, there aren't enough bathrooms, all that stuff. And that makes architects influential. I mean, you are actually dealing with people where they live, quite literally, and can help to shape the way they think. And in my world, it is architects in small firms who are most active in things like the AIA Urban Design Committee, the Baltimore Architecture Foundation, most active in shaping the way the public thinks about the built environment.
We will return to our conversation after this quick break to say thank you to our platform sponsors here at Entree Architect, FreshBooks, Gusto, and RCAT. There's a lot to love about being an entrepreneur architect, but trying to figure out our financials on our own? No, it's not one of them. Luckily, there's FreshBooks, the all-in-one accounting solution that's built for businesses like ours. FreshBooks takes all the not-so-fun parts of running a business, from building and tracking invoices to organizing expenses to managing online payments. Takes all of that and automates it and simplifies it, saving you up to 11 hours a week in the process. FreshBooks has your back at tax time too. With a ton of reports to choose from, you'll know exactly where your business stands, and you can easily hand the keys off to your accountant so they can take over when it's time to reconcile everything for the year. So try FreshBooks for free for 30 days. No credit card required. Go to freshbooks.com/architect and enter Entree Architect in the How Did You Hear About Us section so they know that you came from Entree Architect. That's freshbooks.com/architect and let them know that you're a member of the Entree Architect community. Running an architecture business is hard. Endless to-do lists, employees to take care of, and your ever-present bottom line. So first of all, kudos to you for staying on top of all of it. And as a listener of the Entree Architect podcast, by now you already know about our friends at Gusto. Gusto built an easier and more affordable way to manage payroll, benefits, and more. They help over 100,000 businesses with tasks like automated payroll tax filing, simple direct deposits, free health insurance administration, 401ks, onboarding tools. You name it, Gusto made it easy. And they really care about the small business owners they work with. Their support team is attentive and helpful. And since money can be tight right now, you'll even get 3 months free once you run your first payroll. Just go to gusto.com/architect and start setting up your business today. And you'll see what I mean when I say easy. Again, that's 3 months of free payroll at gusto.com/architect. You're going to love Gusto. Get started today at gusto.com/architect. We are well underway here in 2021, and still, no word from most trade shows. We can't wait around for news on which event is proceeding, which is postponed again, and which are canceled. We still need our continuing education credits. And let's not wait until December like we did last year. Let's start planning right now. How are we going to get our 2021 continuing education credits? Our friends at RCAT can help. Along with manufacturer product information, specifications, CAD, and BIM, all free by the way, RCAT also provides a list of over 150 manufacturers with accredited continuing education courses. Start earning those credits today at rcat.com/CES. It's another free resource RCAT provides to make your life easier. Free continuing education credits. Available now at rcat.com/CES. That's rcat.com/CES. FreshBooks, Gusto, and RCAT. Please visit our platform sponsors today and thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. I think that the post-war architecture, the development that's being built, even the development that's being built today, is a tremendous opportunity for architects, because there are so many architects that complain about the development that's happening today, the big developers and the sprawl that's happening. And yes, I agree. I think that there are many, many problems with that. But those buildings are going to age, and those buildings are going to need assistance and renovations and redevelopment, because those buildings are not being built to last as long as a row house is being built to last. And so I think there are opportunities today, much like what you said, Charles, about post-war homes needing, you know, more modern updates and things like that. But I see opportunities for architects in the future to be able to go into some of these developments that are happening today and continue to have impact on those buildings after they've been built.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when people ask me, you know, why did I spend 7 years writing a book? Partly it was because it was fun. I wanted to write a book. I wanted to see if I could do it. But mostly it's because as I've done what I've done for 35 years, I have found that the American literature of architecture and city planning is pretty much useless to me. And if you look at Architectural Record, look at any magazine, it's all about skyscrapers and suburbs. And the best examples of what to do with moderate density environments are in the Netherlands. Okay, but what happens if you can't read Dutch? Well, I can't read Dutch. The second best examples are in the UK. Well, that's great. Try reading a UK publication and you get bogged down in all these government acronyms about how they finance things, and it's very difficult to figure out what they're talking about. We need an international dialogue. If we're going to figure out how to build good environments that Americans will actually want to live in and will allow us to live with a decent carbon footprint, there are people who can teach us, but we're not in dialogue with them. The Dutch are the world champions at this. They are just amazing. And if an American had to move to Paris, an American would have to learn just a huge number of new social skills, and it's very different. But if an American, you know, moved to Holland, the only thing she'd have to do was learn to ride a bike. I mean, that's you know, it's plug and play. We can do this, but we need an international dialogue.
I think your book is a good start for that. I think your book, because you do research all these cities and show how they are similar and alike, but you also share the history of these cities and you talk about the future of these cities. And so I think that it's an important book. I think it's a book that architects should be reading, not only if you're interested in cities, but if you're interested in the future of architecture. I think it's a very a good place to start. You published the book in 2019, prior to the pandemic.
Great time to do that, I should say.
Yeah. Our world has changed pretty significantly since 2019. In 2020, the world sort of ground to a halt and then rebooted. And, you know, how do you think that the cities will be affected by that? How have they, how will they adapt to the new world that we're living in terms of the health crisis, but also with this new way of working, right? Many of us are now working remotely, and many of us will continue to work remotely. I don't think this will last forever the way we're working, but certainly remote work is part of the permanent work culture. How do you think the pandemic and this new way of working will affect North American or North Atlantic cities, but also cities throughout the world?
Well, you know, everybody who writes for any major newspaper is trying to figure this one out too. And philosophers are trying to figure it out. We're all trying to figure it out. The obvious thing, I think, is that people are going to want their living spaces to have an extra room that can function as an office. And there probably won't be as much single-purpose office space. And it may not be a good time in history to own an airport hotel. If I have one piece of advice for architects who do housework, it is spend time with realtors, and not just once in your life, but on a regular basis. Find realtors who are active in the neighborhoods where you work or the neighborhoods where you want to work, and stay in touch with them. Because realtors know more about the housing market than anybody. They know what people actually are looking for. People are not always looking for what they ought to look for, but they are always looking for what they do look for. And nobody knows more about that than the people who have to live or die with getting people what they want in houses, and that's realtors. So, if you want to have a side job as a realtor, that's a good idea. If you want to marry a realtor, that's a good idea. If you're not, don't do either of those things, just, make friends with one and check in every now and then. Learn what they're learning. Kick ideas around with them.
Yeah, for sure. I think about the way cities were designed at one time where your workspace and your living space was very close, maybe even the same building, where you would your commerce would be at the bottom floor and you would live above your store. Right. And that was the way many of the cities developed because of the way that we lived then. And then we changed and we evolved and we pushed work out either inside of the city and we moved our living outside of the city or today or recently things have even flipped where we live in the city and the big corporate headquarters are outside of the city. So now you're commuting outside of the city. Mm-hmm. But I think recently, even before the pandemic, much of it has started to come back to this live work space, and developers are starting to develop more of this kind of space. But now with the way that the pandemic has sort of changed the way that we're working currently, Do you think that will even make that change even more rapid, that developers will start looking at this new way of living and working and respond in a way that will change the way cities are developed in the future?
Maybe. I don't think that, I don't think what we've learned in the pandemic is going to shape cities as much in the next 30 years as dealing with climate change. I think that's going to be the big driver, and everything will be secondary to that. But this plays well with that. I mean, right. If people are spending more time at home, they're not driving to work. So that I would think is important. However, I think it can be overstated. I would not want to be starting my career right now.
As a developer?
As anything. Because, you know, if you start your career, you have to learn from people who've done it longer than you have. And face it, you have to figure out who the boss is and how to impress the boss. And that it's okay. You can maintain relationships with Zoom or Google Teams, but it's really hard to build them. So, you know, it's fine if you're 67 years old like me, what do you care? But if you're starting your career, by God, you want to have colleagues and you want to know them and you want to find out what they're good for and what they're not. And when you're, you know, when there's something that you can do, you want to show off. You may want to make sure everybody knows it. But, you know, if you're an architect in sole practice, great. You know, just set up in some room in your house and the world is made for you. But I do think in most people work for larger organizations, not just in architecture, but everywhere. And face-to-face contact is how we find out who we, and boy, that's awkward. Face-to-face contact is how each of us finds out what the others of us are like and what we're good for and what we're not good for. It's really hard to do remotely, I think.
Maybe. Yeah.
You do more remote stuff than I do. You may have a different opinion. I'd like to learn from you.
Well, I've been working remotely for many, many years, way before the pandemic. And there are ways to build relationships. And I have relationships with people I've never met face to face, who I consider very close friends. But it's not the same. It's a different type of relationship. And so, you know, things have changed. Things will remain the same. There's lots of different, everything evolves, right? If you look at the history, even if you go through your book and you look at the history of North Atlantic cities, it's all an evolution. And those cities started differently than they are today. And today they will continue to evolve. You mentioned in the book that past cities were cities of industry and commerce, and that today, You write that successful cities are cities of friendship and love. Mm-hmm. Can you explain that? I love that. I have an idea of what that means. Could you explain that so people can understand that?
Yeah. I think, you know, when I was growing up and people said, well, why do you need cities? The answer was you need to have large industrial workforces and you need to have large pools of, you know, secretaries typing for executives in office buildings. You need to have people living close to each other. And by the 1970s, that was getting to be over. For better or worse, it was getting to be over. There are two things that are really shaping cities now in our world, in the developed world, in the first world. The first thing is that a much higher percentage of us have college or university educations. You know, as late as 1940, only 5% of Americans had ever been to college. And now half of us have been to college, and more than a third of us are college graduates, and a lot of us have advanced degrees. And that is a sign that you're interested in book learning. It's a sign that you're good at the sort of school tasks of listening and talking, and that you like doing it. So that's the first thing. A lot of college-educated people. Second thing is, there are just a lot of adults who do not have children at home. Two-thirds of American households right now do not have children at home on any given day. And what people want, what adults want when they're not raising children is really different from what they want when they are raising children. you're raising children, you want safe play space and good schools. If you're not raising children, you want things to do, people to see, public life, neighbors. And cities are made for educated people who are not raising children. Cities are really good at the things that independent adults want. And if you wonder why it is that a lot of cities are bouncing back from the urban crisis of the 1960s and 70s, just look at what they're doing. And what they're doing is tuning themselves up for independent adults.
Yeah, very much so. You look even in a city like New York City, where they are focusing, and this is happening throughout the world, where public spaces are becoming more of a priority. They're creating pedestrian zones. They're creating places where people can live, work, and play very close to each other, right? So they don't need cars. And I think with Uber and the future of autonomous vehicles, this will happen even more, where people don't have cars anymore and they live in a place where they can walk to wherever they want to go. And when they need a car, you know, they go on their phone and they push a button and an autonomous car pulls up and you hop in it and you go where you need to go. And then you get out and that car drives away and you never see it again. That's a future that's coming very soon. Mm-hmm. And that will all affect cities. And I'm really excited about where cities are headed today. If you were going to design a new city as a nonprofit developer and you have this opportunity, somebody comes to you and says, okay, we're going to design a new city from scratch. And you have any budget you want and you have no limits, you can do what you want to do. What are some of the things that we should learn from cities of the past, like North Atlantic cities, to build the cities of tomorrow?
Mm-hmm. I think you can learn from our traditions that there are, that you need to have a strong city center. It should be, at this point, a mixed-use city center. It should have a lot of jobs, office jobs, but it should also have people living. And it should be a major center where people go to do things. It should have, a spectacular park. It should have some theaters. It should have a bunch of restaurants, whatever it should have. But the city should have a center. The city should feel that it is a place. The citizens should have some place where they, when they think of their city, something comes into their mind. There is a place.
The heart of the city.
The heart of the city. And what Ed Bacon used to call the spiritual center of the cities.
Yeah.
Man, Ed Bacon. And you need a good mass transit system. And good means that nobody has to wait for very long. The industry standard is 4 minutes at rush hour and 8 minutes the rest of the day. Anything you can do to reduce that makes life better. London is now 2 minutes. Between one underground train and another. And it's really liberated the people of London. Urban transit is really different from commuter transit. Urban transit is about, you want to go across town, you've got a date with somebody on the other side of town, you have to transfer a couple of times, and you don't want to wait too long when you're transferring. Commuter transit is just, got to catch the 703, and the 703 right. Better get there at 703 or I get fired. So mass transit's a big part of it. I think the American cities on average, except New York, don't have enough apartments and they need more. But to the extent that we're building new housing for families or for people who just want to have more space and can afford it, the North Atlantic tradition offers good models. In its row house building traditions. So I think those are the things that I would learn. And I'd take the big suburban arterials, figure out how you can put apartment houses on them. Then you've got enough density to support transit. That's what I think would be fun in the next generation.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's I think a lot of the cities today that are growing up like Charlotte, they have a lot to learn. I mean, what you just said, I know that Charlotte has a terrible mass transit system. terrible traffic. It's all built on highways and cars, and you can't get from one side of the, and it's not even a large city. You can't get from one side of the city at rush hour to the other side of the city in less than an hour. Anyway, however you do it. And so they have lots to learn. And I think that on cities that have that no restriction of density and that sprawl will happen. But I think it needs to be in a way that mass transit fits into that as well, that allows those people who live on the outskirts of the city to be able to get to where they want to go very quickly. And that's all part of it.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think electric cars and autonomous vehicles may help us in some ways to meet the challenge of climate change, but not in all, because sprawl itself imposes enormous costs. Think of all the road you have to pave. Think of all the sewer and water lines you have to lay, all of that stuff. And it just makes everything more difficult. If you've got a city that's big enough to take up a lot of space, it won't be enough to have a strong center. You'll need to have, you know, subordinate centers that mm-hmm. are a fairly big deal. And the successful cities that I can think of, London, Amsterdam, Manchester in the UK, Washington, Boston, are all good at that. And, you know, if you're in Cambridge, Massachusetts, you don't sit around wishing you were in Boston. Cambridge is just fine.
And I think when cities are built like that, and they are built as cities of friendship and love, and you create these city centers where people want to be, that are magnetic, they attract people to them. Mm-hmm. They become places of that you really enjoy being. That also helps, right? I mean, zoning is a big piece of it, right? They have to create some sort of zoning, especially in these mm-hmm. these cities yep. that, like Charlotte. If you don't create that zoning and there's no physical deterrent from this sprawl, then the only way you can do that is by zoning. But if you also create the city centers that are more appealing, that are more attractive, more people will want to be there, and that density will grow just out of a natural organic people wanting to be there.
Yeah, well, and then you've got to be careful how you deal with that. You can be overly dense. You can make it impossible to have families in urban areas. You can have it all just for yuppies. And the market will do that. And if you want to do something else, you have to do it.
Yeah. Yep. So Charles, this is a fascinating conversation. I could go on for more and more hours, and we've already been way over where I promised you we would stop. But I'm really interested in the subject. But I'd love to just wrap up on talking to the small firm architects that we have listening here today. They're small firm architects trying to build better businesses. So what is one thing that a small firm architect can do today that could build a better business for tomorrow?
Well, if I knew how to build good businesses, I might not be in the nonprofit sector. So whatever I say, take it with a grain of salt. But I think the two things that a small firm architect needs to know about, there's so many things a small firm architect needs to know about. I mean, but you've got to know how people are doing whatever it is that you're designing for. You've got to, whether it's living or working or being bench scientists or whatever you're designing for, schools, you've got to stay up with the debate over the trends. And nobody knows what's going to happen in 5 years, but there's a lively debate on what's going to happen in 5 years and all of those things. What are schools going to be like? What are kitchens going to be like? What's an office layout going to be like? And you need to participate in that debate somehow, whether it's by talking to people or reading things or listening to podcasts or something. You've got to pay attention to that. And then I don't need to tell any modern architect that you need to know how buildings are put together. I am so grateful to my architect friends, because construction technologies are a lot faster changing than it looks. And I can't keep track of it, and I'm very grateful to architects and builders who can. The final thing is, here's where small firm architects are the most important architects in the world, from my point of view. Because again, my point of view is not skyscrapers or shopping malls. My point of view is the houses of the people. How do people live? It's the houses of the people that take up most of the space in any community. Those are the things that define a community. How do Baltimore drunks find their way home at night? And in every generation, the houses of the people need to be different from what they were in the generation before, because the people are different. Their families are smaller or larger. They come from different countries with different cultural traditions. Think of the changes in kitchen design that came as a result of the women's movement. Mom didn't have to be isolated from the rest of the family, and the kitchen became a family room. These are big changes in architecture. And the most efficient thing that we can do to house our people is to make use of the buildings we've already got, the embodied energy they already have. And so that requires the kind of work that Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill is never going to do. All that work is either going to be done without architects at all, or it's going to be done by architects in small firms. I am a regular patron of small firm architects, particularly one, a friend of mine, who has designed more Baltimore row house renovations than anybody in human history. And he really, really, really feels it in his bones. He really knows it. And it is just so exciting. We've got things under construction right now. And he's been doing it for 30 years. And he understands construction and design and history. And he is an incredibly valuable citizen. And because he's done a lot of it, people like me can afford to hire him. It's really very exciting.
His name is Charles B. Duff. The book is The North Atlantic Cities. You can learn more about Charles and the book at northatlanticcities.com, northatlanticcities.com. Charles, you also do a lot of speaking, right? So you do AIA chapters and other things like that. Could you share a little bit about that?
To your audience out there in podcast land, if you belong to an AIA chapter, I'd like to speak to it. If your chapter has an architectural foundation, I'd like to speak to it. If you're part of a preservation group or a neighborhood association, I'd like to speak to it. And if you're a graduate of a school of architecture, I think I may assume you are, I'd like to speak to it. I don't charge anything. I want to get an idea out there.
You can reach out to Charles at northatlanticcities.com. We will have links to everything over at the show notes. You can just go to the show notes. You'll have links to all of this. Charles, this has been a really interesting conversation, something that I really passionately feel about as well. So thank you for sharing your knowledge here today at Entree Architect Podcast.
Great fun. Thank you so much. And see you in Baltimore when the pandemic's over.
You are listening to episode 363 with Charles Duff, the author of The North Atlantic Cities. This is an episode to share, right? That was super interesting. What a fantastic conversation. I really enjoyed my time with Charles. The episode number is 363. If you'd like to access the show notes for all the links or share this episode with a friend, the link is entrearchitect.com/episode363. Please just type that right now into an email and send it to just one friend. I would appreciate that. This is episode 363, entrearchitect.com/episode363. Entree Architect is proud to be a partner with the largest, most engaged AEC multimedia network on the planet, Gable Media. Have you been there? We are curating thought leadership for an audience dedicated to building a better world. Listen and subscribe to all the shows. These are shows that we are building for you. So go check it out at gablemedia.com. That's gablemedia.com, gablemedia.com. And check out Entree Architect Academy membership. If you're not yet a member of the Entree Architect Academy membership, you need to be there. We have ready to edit business resources. We have live monthly training. We have a supportive architect community. It's waiting for you. And now, Simple Systems, our new business system program developed for small firm entrepreneur architects. We're building business systems for you, and they are free to members. It's all waiting for you at Entree Architect Academy membership. Learn more about membership at entrearchitect.com/join. That's entrearchitect.com/join. Go check that out and see what you think. Be well, my friends. Be healthy, happy, safe, and secure. Thanks for listening today. I really appreciate it. Love, learn, and share what you know.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure, and when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark Arlepage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.